Okay, I hope you caught that video there. Good morning. Good morning. It is April 7th, 2026. Right? If I'm getting that right. Ay, ay, ay. The brain is a little whatever. We are going to meditate for a little while, about 20 minutes. That's in Buddhist terms, that's a little while. Some people think that's a long time. Somebody's not muted, and okay, I can mute it. I did my mute all thing, and then I'll talk. I'm actually gonna, as I said a moment ago, I'm gonna read from Ajahn Pasno's book on loving kindness, which I've been going through again, something that I drew on quite a bit when I was writing my own book, Living Kindness. Okay. Hope you're ready. Jump right in to meditating, doing nothing. All right. I will realign my own posture. I actually might be concerned. I have a new phone that, don't know all the details of, but I need to make sure it is not going to make noise. Okay. So just settling back into comfortable meditation posture, something that allows you to both relax and still stay clear-headed or alert. And that's the first kind of balance that we work with in meditation, the energetic balance. You can close your eyes or just lower your gaze. And just so you understand, when I say lower your gaze, meaning you don't have to close your eyes. I say that because some people, particularly trauma survivors, are uncomfortable closing their eyes, and more typically in a public space. So hopefully if you're at home, you don't get triggered with your eyes closed, but even then it can be a trigger. So if that's something that comes up, some anxiety or fearful feelings show up, and just sit with your eyes open. No need to close them. Mindfulness is not something that we have to have really special circumstances for. You could be mindful in different postures, different situations. Eyes open, eyes closed. And here I suggest that you then check in with your body, how you're holding your body, and by holding, partly I mean posture, but also holding in the sense of tension or tightness, if you're holding some part of your body in a tight way. So just to check in, see how your shoulders are. Notice your belly, your jaw. It's a sense of releasing through the body. And feeling the breath then moving in the body. and feeling the sensations of breath, the feeling of breathing in, breathing out. And the breath can be located different areas. You can feel it at the nostrils, touch of air. You can feel it in the chest and the belly as they rise and fall. But further, we can kind of see the effects of the breath throughout the energetic system. And this is where the idea of calming the body with the breath comes in. Calming the mind with the breath. This is a subtle, intuitive process, not a mechanical one, not something you can force. Well, we think of it as inclining the mind or inclining the body. Inclining the body doesn't mean physically inclining, but having a sense of a calming energy that is potentially accessible to you. And we incline toward that calming. Again, this is really metaphorical. But it points to the idea of a non-striving effort. When we strive in meditation, try to make something happen, that tends to create more stress, more grasping. A non-striving is a sense of opening to a potential and seeing if that potential experience is available to you right now. Have you laid the conditions for it? So this is inclining, turning toward, opening to. And you may find that that's just enough to ease you into a little bit more settled state. Or you may find that it's not enough, that nothing happens, or that there's resistance. Well, if that happens, we accept that, we let go of that particular effort, just sit with whatever is arising. With mindfulness, difficulties can be engaged just as much as pleasant meditative experiences. Certainly, we all want calm and peace. But how do we handle it when those aren't available? Can we be okay with that? Right. Hope that that was pleasant for people, useful or something. I've been, as I'm sure many of you do, I kind of, work gradually through a Dharma book, little by little, and the one I've been reading lately is Ajahn Pasano's book, Abundant, Exalted, Immeasurable, which I was reading from on Sunday morning for the Dharma Bums Temple, which I saw Mike here before. He's the one of the facilitators there in San Diego. If you're ever in San Diego, I highly recommend going, dropping by that Dharma Bums Temple. Wonderful place, and they have a recovery group there, as well as many different sittings and events. In any case, Abundant, Exalted, Immeasurable is a book that it's available as an ebook, so to be downloaded for free, published in 2016, but it's based on a, according to the foreword, I think it's the foreword, it's based on a retreat that was given in September of 2008. And as I say, Ajahn Pasano, and it was a loving kindness or metta retreat. And Ajahn Pasano is pretty funny because he says in the beginning of it, this is the second retreat I've led in California in 12 years. So, not teaching a lot of retreats there, Ajahn Pasano. Ajahn Pasano is more engaged in training monks, training the young monks, than he is in sort of teaching the broader world, which was more the Ajahn Amaro's role in at Abayagiri. So if all of this is just sounds like mumbo jumbo or some foreign language, part of it is a foreign language. Abayagiri is the Thai Forest Monastery in Northern California. Abaya means fearless, Giri means mountain, so that's the name of the place. Abundant, Exalted, Immeasurable is a line from the Simile of the Saw, the famous sutta. I wrote a chapter on it in Living Kindness. And it comes, there's a line where the Buddha it's a line repeated over and over in the sutta as an instruction about how to handle, how to respond to your enemies, where the Buddha says something like, I think I have it pretty memorized, but I might not have every word. Something like, one should, this is how one should think. Like, my mind will remain unaffected, and I shall utter no evil words. I shall abide compassionate for their welfare with a mind of loving kindness. I shall abide pervading them with a mind imbued with loving kindness. And starting with them, I shall abide pervading the all-encompassing world with a mind imbued with loving kindness, abundant, exalted, immeasurable, without hostility and without ill will. It's a great instruction, and in that classic way that the Buddha talks about loving kindness, it suggests, on the one hand, pervading the all-encompassing world with a mind imbued with loving kindness, sort of this positive idea. But then he always adds in the sort of the other side, without hostility and without ill will. So as I've talked about, I think sometimes it's easier to not hate than it is to actively love, particularly when we're talking about our enemies. To not hate your enemy is more accessible, I think, for most people than to love them. Anyway, it's a passage that I love and that I use in my own practice, just that I repeat to myself. And if you're looking for it, it's in the, as I said, the simile of the saw, which is in the Majjhima Nikaya number 21. And so, as usual, Monica has helpfully given you a link to the PDF of the book, as well as a link to the simile of the saw. Thank you, Monica. You are a treasure. Thank you. I figured you would do that, so I didn't even say anything. Hey. Or if you saw, what's it called? Project Hail Mary. Yeah, that's a few people did, apparently, the ones who were laughing. I'm going to read a little passage here from Abundant, Exalted, Immeasurable. Starts on page 12 in the chapter called Metta, a Mature Emotion. I remember one time traveling as a translator and attendant to a very senior, well-known, and highly respected Thai monk, Lumpur Panyananda. A few people in the room here have met him before. So this is a transcription of his Dharma talk, so different room. When I took a group to Thailand, we went to pay respects to him. Now there is someone with serious punya. So he's been using this word punya, which is, sorry, I better go back and get the, okay. There's a word in Buddhist jargon. In Pali, it is punya. In the Thai language, boon. Inevitably, Thai people have been to the West, who've been to the West, or have met a Westerner who is studying Buddhism. How do you translate boon? But the Buddha himself said punya is another word for happiness. It is the result of skillful action, good, wholesome actions or activities that result in happiness and well-being for you and for others. Generosity and giving are punya. Keeping precepts and virtue are punya. Meditation is punya. Listening to teachings is punya. Teaching is punya. Giving the opportunity for other people to access teachings is punya. Helping others, acts of service are punya. Delighting in the good that other people do is punya. Dedicating the blessings that come from your own good actions is punya. There are many levels, but these are avenues for creating happiness. So I think that gives you an idea what punya is. Okay. So Lumpur Panyana, sorry, Panyananda. I'll get it. Is someone who, with serious punya, he's done a lot of good things at this life. Okay. A whole life of giving. When we went to Thailand to visit him, he was sick and in the hospital, but it was a hospital that he had built. He was about 96 at the time, but very bright. Traveled here with him in the 1980s, and one time we were in New Zealand. It was the evening session, chanting, meditation, Dharma talk, and question afterwards. One of the questions that somebody asked fairly early on was, how do you deal with that feeling of guilt? Of course, I was familiar with that feeling. But the interesting thing was that when I tried to translate it, I realized I didn't know what the word for guilt is in Thai. I had been translating for teachers and studying the language and the Dhamma for years, but my mind drew a blank, so I burst out laughing. I explained to him, to Lumpur Panyananda, what the question was, why I was laughing, and how the concept was a bit distant in the Thai language and culture. I had to explain to him what Westerners do with their minds to make themselves feel guilty. He listened and got this very concerned look on his face as I was explaining how guilt works. When I finished the explanation, he said, "Oh, that's really suffering. Tell them not to do that." It isn't as if Thai people don't have these emotions. There is a very healthy place for remorse, but not that complication of guilt, which is so easy to carry around because of the strong sense of me and judgment. We judge, compare, and divide ourselves into me and this world that we are either trying to live up to or being intimidated by. These are very painful distinctions. An act of loving kindness comes with the attitude of this is the way things are, in the sense that there is a recognition, quote, well, that's just a feeling. I'm going to get some space around that, not contend with it, and not slip into those thoughts of comparison and suffering that accompany it. Unquote. That is an act of loving kindness toward oneself. It's a very useful skill to be able to see somebody who is doing something good and then be able not to make a judgment about yourself, torturing yourself. I think that sometimes when we see loving kindness as one of the Brahmaviharas, the divine abidings that puts it out there somewhere, that puts it out there somewhere. The divine, that's way off somewhere else. One of the monks in England has started translating Brahmavihara as, quote, e mature emotion, unquote. And that's a skillful way of bringing attention to that aspect. It is a mature emotion to be able to turn attention to loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity. The doorway into them all is the quality of loving kindness. Bring attention to that consciously, and then also bring attention to what obstructs it. We can start to pay attention to the immature emotions, which are fairly accessible, and recognize there's that twinge of jealousy, there's that twinge of comparing, there's that irritation. Rather than letting them gain momentum, you can ask, how can I bring a mature emotion into this? How can I create some space around this? So, think there's a lot in here, in just a few paragraphs. And, Ajahn Pasano, if you ever have the chance to sit with him, I really recommend that. He kind of embodies the simple Buddhist monk. He doesn't project a lot of, he's not a showman, and he's quite low-keyed. But when you're with him, you feel this kind of warmth and acceptance and caring. What this kind of got to me because I was, as usual, I have to talk about myself. But I mean, why this was particularly resonating for me. A couple months ago, some group, someone, I don't know, representing some group, invited me to speak on some kind of a panel or something that they were there having. And I was busy at the time. I was like, get to me later. And then heard from them again. And so I was like, okay, sure, June, fine, let me know. And it's like, okay, well, we need you to like fill out this website. So I go to their website. It's like, and on it says, how many people are on your email list? The minimum is 8,000. And I was like, otherwise. And so I was like, so I went to my little thing. I was mentioning this on Sunday. My email list, it continues to shrink. Like, I'm not working the email list. And I'm like, well, that's not it. 8,000, but I'll just put in the number. So he writes back to me, I'm sorry, we're going to not invite you because you don't have 8,000 followers. And then I'm like, oh, like I thought I was famous. People buy my books and they tell me how great I am. Like, aren't I wonderful? Like, I'm not famous enough. What's the problem here? And of course, I was like, okay, am I going to have a resentment? And the way I work up my resentments generally is I start complaining to my wife about them, and then she tries to talk me out of it and look at it in a different way. And I was like, I don't want to go through this whole thing with Rosemary because, I'll be embarrassed and she'll like make. So I'm just going to not do this. I'm not going to get a resentment. So I've been sort of not getting a resentment the last couple of days. But it's just like one of those things, right? I know that some people look at me as like, oh my God, you're like this famous writer. Like, oh, you're so amazing, And then other people are like, you don't have enough followers, right? For us to even like let you talk to us, I'm like, well, which am I? Which, of course, is like, oh, the answer to that question is neither, right? Because, I mean, right? The comparing mind, or better than somebody, worse than others. There just is no getting there. I mean, you have to get fully enlightened, and then there's nobody who can beat you. You're the winner then. But the thing is, if you get fully enlightened, you're not allowed to tell anybody except other fully enlightened people, and they're not going to be impressed, So, it's kind of disappointing. Like, oh wow, like, I've got all this success and status, but I don't get to reap the benefits. But of course, if you're fully enlightened, you don't care about that anyway. We'll have to, take that for what it's worth. But it's a the whole story, Ajahn Panyadanda, and the just don't do that, right? Like, is great, and realizing, I mean, one of the things that's interesting about this, and you may have heard stories like this, because there's one very similar about the Dalai Lama saying, it's almost the same story. At first is just realizing that maybe there are these cultural differences, and maybe our culture, and when I say our, I guess Western, because it's American, it's more American than it is even Western, because I'm not sure but it's somewhat European too. But people kind of associate it with like Protestant guilt or Catholic guilt or Jewish guilt or something, I guess there isn't Buddhist guilt. I don't know. At least that's the suggestion here. So, I mean, I think that's an interesting sort of, factoid or whatever, reflection is like, oh, that this thing that maybe we accept as normal is actually just conditioned. It's not human, and so that's a little bit tricky, because I think one of the ways we try to navigate our minds and our sort of emotional world is in the sense of comparing, not necessarily comparing good or bad, but just sort of considering, just sort of seeing your mental activity as quote normal, as what people do. And if we can see that, well, actually no, that there's no not every human thinks like this or views the world like this. I mean, I don't, that doesn't necessarily mean that hearing that you're going to stop doing it, but it can help in terms of when, that kind of trying to step away and consider, well, what's going on and how valid is it? How useful is it? How credible is it? Do I need to believe this? Is it useful in some way? Because obviously, like, looking at our own minds and even, I mean, I'll use the word judging ourselves has a value, that it's not that we want to just be like, oh well, everything just is the way it is. It's like, no, we're all trying to be, better people or do wholesome things. I mean, many of us are. There are some people who aren't at all, but so questioning, oh, that what I the way I'm thinking isn't helpful, and that's really negative, and I quote shouldn't do that, or I want to not do that. It's not necessarily a bad thing, right? We in Buddhism we have these terms for a conscience and our sort of social awareness, Hiri and Otapa, these two qualities that are called actually the protectors of the world, the guardians of the world, because we need to, be aware. Is this destructive? Is this harmful? What I'm doing, what I'm thinking, what I'm saying. And the awareness of, that an internal awareness that, that lets me know, like, oh, this is wrong, what we call conscience. But then that's Hiri, and then Otapa is this external awareness, which is kind of like, I don't want to do things that other people are going to disparage or see as harmful. I don't want to be seen as a bad person. So those things are important, but they're different from what Ajahn Pasano was talking about. This person asked this question of the Thai monk, how do we deal with guilt when it's, and people talk about this in relation to shame as well. So here we're talking about an internalized, self-created negative view that's not based on actual harm that we've done or anything that other people would see as harmful objectively. And as I say that, I immediately think, well, yeah, when this often gets internalized because as children we get told that we're bad in some way, or maybe not told directly, although sometimes it is direct, but sometimes just implicitly we get this message. And so that's not otapa, where like the greater world sees that you've done harm. Rather, it's a neurotic, dysfunctional family system that, projects negativity onto you that you internalize. And that's where a lot of this presumably comes from. Certainly, that's the Western psychological understanding of it. Who knows, to try to dissect all of that. But clearly, so there's this challenge that we're being put to, I think, that I'm describing, which is I want to act skillfully, wholesomely, and wisely, but I don't want to beat myself up for things that aren't my fault or or make up stories about myself. And I think that, the unwholesome, the unhelpful stuff that the monk says just stop doing is really very much comparing mind. I mean, that's one of its manifestations, is just comparing mind. Oh, other people are good and I'm bad. Other people have more people on their mailing list than I do. And I think that great line that I think, I don't know if it comes out of the 12-step world, but it's where I've learned it. Comparing your own insides to other people's outsides is like the really pernicious form of comparing, because it's clearly not real. And all you have to do is walk into a meditation hall and see all these people, or just like open your eyes when you're on Zoom and everybody's meditating, and if you project out, oh, they all look so peaceful, they're really having a great meditation, and I'm just sitting here, drawing up my grocery list. What, I'm a failure and they're good. Because what's going on inside you. You don't know what's going on inside them, and it's probably not as different from what's going on inside you. But all of this is, I think, the stuff that we have to navigate in our lives. And as I speak to you as a group of people who, many of you are here, have been with in this group for years, and others, are here regularly. And so I speak to you as a group of people who I believe are really want to do the right thing and really want to cultivate wholesome states and wholesome behaviors. And so I don't mean this for everybody in the world, but for, I will say for us, I think we're a maybe self-selecting group of people who want to do skillful things. And like many people, we question our value and we question, whether we are good or whether we could do more or whether we could be better. And again, and the answer is yes and no, kind of, yes, we could be better, of course, that we could do better, but we have to find a way to be at peace with what we're able to do. I mean, this is certainly one of the advantages to getting old, is starting to see, like, for one, like, no, I'm probably never going to be as perfect as I, think I should be. Like, if there was a time when I was actually like striving and imagining some, apotheosis of, perfect, being the perfect something, that's not going to happen. I mean, this is sometimes conveyed as the day that you realize you're never going to be the shortstop for the New York Yankees. Now, that's all a very specific dream, but these sort of dreams that we might have, but and the other advantage of getting old is that you simply don't have the energy to bother with all of it anymore. But it doesn't mean, right, that you're not gonna, try to continue. You're just gonna, they have these horrible commercials. I watch too much TV because of, I'll blame it on sports and politics. But anyway, they have these horrible commercials for Lazy Boy, whatever. What are those things? Loungers, I guess. And they kind of drive me crazy because they make it look like what people want to do is nothing. Like, my ideal, the thing that I would love to do with my day is do nothing. And this is the idea of retirement, right? And I think there was a time, when it really was an ideal in our society was to retire and do nothing. And then it turned out that when people did that, their risk of heart attack rose about 90%, right? People like always were keeling over, oh, my retirement, it's great. Come. And so, most of us, I know a bunch of you enough to know that you're of retirement age and you ain't retired, in any way. But I watch these ads and I think, why would somebody want to just do nothing? Like, that's not fun. Like, doing nothing is not fun. Not for me, So I guess I'm just talking about balance here and the challenge of finding balance. And the idea of balance in and of itself, I mean, has the idea of comparing in it. And so it's not that we're not going to compare, and yet can we compare without creating pain? That's I'll just leave you with that as your koan for the day. Can you compare yourself and try to make yourself better without causing yourself pain? So thank you for your kind attention, and let us we'll open it up for any comments. And I'm going to just say one more, just to throw in something odd for the morning. I see that we don't have Steve here, but I know Steve has something of tinnitus or tinnitus, if you prefer. And it's very quiet around my house right now because I'm here alone. And this morning, as I was making the bed, I was like, "Are there some birds in the tree outside the window?" And I opened the window. I was like, "Nope, that sound is the birds in your ear." Like my left ear has like but it's kind of like pleasant, like one of those like Spotify like nature recordings. I have it like just playing in my left ear. So anyway, Tanya, hi, nice to see you.
Hi, good to see you and
Yeah.
everyone.
Things are exciting in Georgia this week, up in Augusta, you might know, but
Oh, is there some kind of
yeah,
sports
there's a golf tournament. Never
going
mind. Go
on?
on.
Sorry, I'm messing with you. I knew about it. Your talk reminded me of what I call the subtle aggression of self-improvement.
Ah,
So
beautiful.
this whole self-improvement thing is
Yeah.
so negative, right?
Yeah, right.
To like no matter, whatever it is about us or our bodies or our faces or our teeth, it's like, and it's not e the self-improvement isn't even targeted at physical, right? It's like
Yeah.
you're just fucked up.
Yeah.
Everything about you needs to be improved. And yeah, there's like this terrible, kind of self-hatred behind that. I also wanted to share that I took my refuge vow on Sunday
Oh, very nice.
through a Shambhala monk, who's the director of a meditation center in Tennessee. So wanted to share that. I'm really happy about it.
Congratulations.
Thank you. Good to see everyone.
Nothing bad will ever happen to you again.
That's what they tell me.
Yeah. Thanks, Tanya. Other thoughts, comments? Oh, great. Kathleen, hello.
Hi, everybody. Can you say anything about what for me has been quite a burden in my life, and that is the guilt of having addictive tendencies or struggling with addiction and recovery.
Thanks for the easy question. No, I think that I'll say a few things. I mean, first of all, regret is one of the diseases of aging, and whether you're an addict or not, I think that's just something that you have to learn to live with, because I think it, virtually everyone has regrets, unless they are sociopaths. And I think that the process of working through the 12 steps, particularly making the amends, is meant to help you to hold that. So, once certainly writing an inventory can bring up a lot of shame, a lot of guilt about the past. But clearly, we're meant to let go of that. And making amends is like a formal way of doing our best to move on. And that, of course, when you do that, you realize, well, I can't possibly, first of all, I can't make amends for all the harm I did. And anyway, because it's like there's too many people in situations and like all of that. But anyway, it doesn't change the fact that the harm was done. And so that means that I have to have some self-forgiveness. I have to be able to say, I have done harm. I regret it. I'm going to continue. I'm going to try to live my life better from here on. So clearly, forgiveness is a is part of this process, and to cultivate that and develop that and what that means. And Jack Kornfield has some great meditations on forgiveness that are pretty easy to find. But the other thing that I think is meant to, or certainly for me, helped me with this issue is going to meetings and being in a community of people who have done similar things and realizing I am not uniquely flawed. All these people here and all these millions of people in recovery have also done bad things. So even though we have done bad things, we aren't the only people who have done it. So that to me is a certain amount of relief, because a lot of that guilt is like, oh, I'm the worst person in the world, and realizing I'm just not, you know, I'm actually just sort of an average bad person, you know, like just like everybody else. I mean, and then you look around the world and you realize, well, you don't have to be an addict to do unskillful things, to do harm. It's just human beings are inherently flawed. You know, the Buddha talks about the underlying tendencies of greed, hatred, and delusion that all human beings have. And our task is to overcome them, to abandon them. And we will always come up a little bit short, at least, on doing that. So, again, forgiveness, self-compassion, and you know, the right being right-sized, right? The not inflation, not deflation, but seeing like, oh, I'm just another, as we say, as the fire sign theater would say, just another bozo on this bus. So, another reference that only a select few will get. But yeah, just look up fire sign theater bozos on this bus, and you'll understand. I don't even really know what the joke is, but it somehow captures something. You don't even have to know what it means. We're just, you know, we're just all bozos on this big human bus. Okay, never mind. Monica. So I hope that's of some use, Kathleen, you know, and I'm not calling you a bozo, so don't take offense. Monica.
You referenced it with the koan, but I'm thinking about our recent retreat. I, after lunch every day, I would hike up the mountain, and my meditation teacher said it's worth looking at. Was that a craving? Wanting to entertain yourself or something rather than sitting still, you know, and you're but then you're like also reminding us as we get older that we need to move. So
Yeah. I mean, first of all, I think it's important if we're being trying to be Buddhists, which I don't really recommend, but if you're trying to be a Buddhist, desire or craving is not a sin. It's not a bad thing. The thing we are interested in is being aware of suffering and the end of suffering, seeing how we create suffering, seeing how we can end it. So if you look at essentially every action of body and mind, there is an element of craving in it, craving or aversion. So if we get, you know, obsessive about it, which you can do, especially on a meditation retreat, it's quite common, it can just paralyze you. So it's not the point, right? You know, just as you're saying, it's like, no, exercise is wholesome. Wanting to take a walk. Like, what happens if something happens and you can't take your walk? Do you go into a crisis? Well, that's, you know, that's a problem. That's not wholesome. But, you know, just you're going to want to do something. So, like, it's okay. I want to lie down. I want to take a walk. I want to clean my bathroom, whatever. It's fine. It's just to notice what happens when you don't get your want. See if you can let go of that. And we'll end with Conrad. Thank you. Nice to see you here.
Hey, Kevin. Yeah.
Hi.
Hi. Yeah, I wanted to just express my appreciation for you making this available. When we were doing the guided meditation earlier, I found myself thinking how I woke up early this morning agitated. I couldn't go back to sleep because there's some things that I would like to. I had that old feeling of just wanting what I used to have, you know, not something better or even
No.
much, just what I used to have, you know,
Yeah.
with some decision that I made recently that is causing some agitation. And it was interesting just to say, okay, let's what am I going to do about this? Am I going to lay in bed and worry and add story upon story? So I just got up and had some coffee and breakfast, and then I sat for a while. And then it occurred to me, there's that thing that I strive for to become something other than what I am, or to get to. And I came up, I don't know if this is a word, but I even came up with the word, either becoming or be ridden. I wanted to get rid of the
Yeah.
stuff that was with me, agitated me, or I wanted to become that thing that I, other than this, you know,
Right.
I thought, is this that, that's it. And it's just about just been able to just, this is what I am.
Yeah.
You know, can use some improvement,
Right.
but this is where I am. You know, I'm being all right with that, you know. So it was a bit of relief to be able to recognize that and come to that again.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, it's like perfect just as you are, but you could always be better. And well, and what you're describing is actually, you know, the three forms of desire that the Buddha says in the Second Noble Truth, the three causes of suffering. There's tanha, which is sensual craving, but then there's the craving to be and the craving to not be. So it's like the becoming or the not becoming. Yeah, thank you. That's a great note to end on. I will just note, and I appreciate again, Monica, all the great resources you put in there. And, you know, she puts in all my c upcoming retreats and all that stuff if you're interested. But also there is this, we still have this Google Doc where people, you know, put their information on there. And if you wanted to connect with someone or ask for help, even maybe don't, I don't, you know, we don't have like sponsorship here in a formal way, but if you wanted to ask someone to connect outside of the class, and obviously we're talking about for only for wholesome spiritual purposes. This is not a dating site, obviously. Anyway, you should check that out. I know there's a bunch of people on there who have connected over the years, so we don't talk about it very much these days. So thank you all for showing up, for continuing to do this work together, and take care of yourselves. We'll see you either tonight at the Berkeley Buddhist Monastery, or next Tuesday, or whenever I see you. So blessings.
Thank
Peace.
you, Kevin. Bye.
Thank
Thank
you,
you, guys.
Kevin. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Kevin, the
Thanks,
last time I
Kevin.
spoke to you, I mentioned that book that I had been missing. I found it the very next day.
Oh, great. Excellent. Good, Conrad. All right. Ending meeting for all.